This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 9th of April, 1959. The title of this lecture is Anatomy. This tape is 55 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Notice that I am lecturing here today without any notes. I hope this doesn't upset you. The data is still factual, even though I don't read it off my own writings. Go on, laugh. Go on. Truthfully speaking, when one looks at the amount of material which one should know about the human mind, the rest of it, I don't know how you can confront it, frankly. I don't. Because it's taken me years to confront it, because I was confronting it on a bit by bit. And I confronted tremendous quantities of super unimportances. Tremendous quantities. You have no idea of the amount of garbage that has been shoveled out of the way, the number of whole beaches which have been removed to find one grain of sand, the number of oceans which have been drained to find the important drop of water. I think it was mainly a matter of pique on my part. Just a little bit of upset that the job really wasn't hard to do, but it just hadn't been done. And I consider this a considerable imposition. If some of the fellows back down the line had just been a little less fixated on their own engram, shall we say, why, maybe they would have seen more, and maybe we wouldn't have to have done quite so much. Which brings us here to a rather a shock point on the track. All of a sudden, why, we accumulate all the information. I frankly don't know why the information was not accumulated before this time of the mid-20th century. I frankly don't know. Because it hasn't proven very difficult to accumulate. Now, the information, most people think in terms of postulates and bric-a-brac and odds and ends. What I'm talking about basically is anatomy. Anatomy, the anatomy of beingness and thinkingness and livingness and so on. And that's what this immediate lecture is about, just anatomy. Now, the medico has his ideas of anatomy. The chemist has his ideas of anatomy. I don't think that anybody in the field of the mind or spirit has ever had any idea of anatomy. Those are two blank areas. We do have some idea, however, of physical anatomy. We do have some idea of the body and the physical universe. Quite a bit of work has been done on that, done some of it in my 16th century. Still, an old textbook is kicking around even today on it. It was the first work done on endocrinology, the glands of the body. Now, chemists can tell you that there's a certain composition in matter. Physicist says space is that which separates matter. I don't know if he has even that much of a definition. Energy, he says, does this and does that. These are quite absurd, and we do know that mist has an anatomy. The anatomy of time is tick-tock. All kinds of mechanisms have been invented, manufactured to measure time and look it over, practically everything except what time is. Many basics are missing here. Nevertheless, there is a subject called anatomy of the physical universe. That is studied by the chemist and physicist. Now, the medical doctor, the resurrectionist, that's an old British term meaning a fellow who digs up bodies in the graveyard and sells them to the medical college. They had pretty good ideas of anatomy. But mental anatomy, here's what's amazing. It didn't even exist before 1950. It wasn't. Everybody who said mind immediately thought he had escaped the whole subject of anatomy. Well, mind's all imaginary. Everything in the mind's imaginary. Why describe it? It's very simple, isn't it? Why describe anything that's imaginary? Well, the fellow just dreamed it up, so it was, of course, of no importance. Well, I don't think this logic was very sensible, because it certainly didn't make very many able people, and it certainly didn't cure any of the things they were trying to cure. So, the test of the pudding is the eating, and they didn't get any pudding to eat. Not any. As far as mental anatomy is concerned, we have some adventurers like Freud talking about the id and the ego and so forth. And then they sail off at once into Oedipus complexes and electrifications. I think that's why psychiatrists shock people, isn't it? Because of the electro complex. I thought it'd make as much sense as anything else, you know. That wasn't anatomy. He didn't say anything was there. He was just describing conditions. Now, in 1950, the first work was released on the subject of something being there. And there is something in the mind. There is something in the mind. One of the interesting proofs that startled a scientific congress less than a year ago, and which was brought out at the Congress and made front page news, was an immediate result of a Scientology experiment, which went as follows. You mock up a mass and shove it into the body, mock up a mass and shove it into the body, mock up a mass and shove it into the body. Actually, if you carry it on for a few weeks, the person's weight changes as much as 30 pounds. He can increase his own weight by as much as 30 pounds in the process of mocking up masses and shoving them in the body. Now, mocking up masses and throwing them away, results in a decrease of weight. Well, now, this is an imaginary mass, isn't it? A fellow, after all, he just dreamed it up. Well, what's it doing weighing on a machine, a scale? Well, what's this all about? And I imagine if you took a very, very, very sensitive spring balance that you could put somebody on that practically wiggle if his heart beat, you know, something that sensitive that could be weigh down almost to the difference of a pencil mark, that you could actually weigh an individual mock-up. Yeah, that's stretching a bit of a bow, you know, a long bow, but you probably could weigh an individual mock-up. Maybe someday some of you will dream up a way to do this. Quite interesting. But long and short of it is mental energy has mass. Mental energy has activity. It has warmth. It has motion. It obeys various electrical phenomena and rules. You can change somebody's weight by running an engram. That's demonstrable. Get rid of an engram that makes him overweight, and he'll get thin. And you can take somebody who's too thin and get rid of an engram that makes him too thin, and he'll gain weight. But I don't mean on that sort of a via, not the change basis. I mean the actual mass of the engram has weight. Now, you see this best on an E-meter. E-meter is very interesting, in that it measures density. Now, some people think an E-meter works because of sweat. That's, by the way, the original work done on the Wheatstone Bridge. They thought it measured sweat. Therefore, it's called a skin galvanometer. And an interesting experiment is to totally powder somebody's hands so that he couldn't possibly sweat, or the sweat couldn't get to the electrodes, and what do you know, it still works. The skin galvanometer is misnamed. All the thing is a resistance meter. And if you look at the guts of an E-meter, you will find nothing there but a resistance meter, something that measures ohms. And the resistance of the usual body, minus a bank, is from 5,000 to 12,500 ohms. And actually, males are one, females are the other. Male and female bodies have different resistances. These are electrical resistances. Now, what about an E-meter, which is measuring 28,000 ohms on a person. I know I'm talking something we don't have to know anything about at all. Don't look so dismayed. An ohm is the Omani Padme of the electronics wizard. He has his own religion, and he measures things which give him resistance in ohms. Just like if you had to pick up a trunk off the floor and it weighed 100 pounds, you'd have weight. Well, how much resistance does an electrical current meet running through a mass, or so forth? And this is all it is. It's just the amount of resistance. They call them ohms. All it means is it's more dense. More dense. Somebody who is running up to 18,000, 24,000 ohms is more dense. And you see that on the tone arm of your E-meter. When that tone arm starts up there at 5, 6, somewhere up in there, it's going into the thousands of ohms of increase of resistance. Now, what's increasing? Your PC isn't getting more dense. Well, I admit that he sounds more dense, but actually, physically, he isn't getting more dense. There is no change in his specific gravity as far as his body is concerned. So this E-meter is hooked onto another electrode called a body. And that body is hooked up to the mind. Do you understand? The only thing which could change this tremendous difference of resistance in the body would be, you might say, standing waves or electrical masses, or just plain energy masses surrounding the body. And true enough, when you get somebody into a grouper, which is just dense, 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 and the whole time track is collapsed, 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 why, he'll register almost off the top of the meter. In fact, the early E-meters, which we had, he did measure well off the top of them. Now, if he's totally in a dispersal and isn't there at all, and is one of these wonderful detached cases, he goes off the bottom of the meter because he isn't connected up to any electrical mass at all. Matter of fact, he sort of, not only does the body become unable to express its own density, but a thetan can pull back to a point of making an electrical vacuum where the body should be. It's pretty good, you know. I mean, when an electronics man looks at this sort of thing, he'd rather go in for skin galvanometers, usually. Explanation of sweat is much easier. And that's mostly because this energy is not always visible to the naked eye. As a matter of fact, you get somebody in rather poor condition, his facsimiles are totally invisible to everybody. But that's a joke. Most everybody is hiding his facsimiles these days. It's the fashion. It's merely a fad, like higher purchase or income tax. They come and they go, you know. Fads come and go. Right now, they hide engrams. The more masses in the mind, the more dense, thick, heavy is the mind, the greater ohms of resistance there is to any current being passed through the vicinity of this mind. Do you understand that?
Yes.
Yeah. It's really quite simple. Now, as an individual pulls out, a being becomes totally disconnected from a body, the body goes down to either 5,000 or 12,500 ohms. The body itself has a certain electrical resistance. A dead body has this resistance. Now, when we are able to put a thetan back in his head or take him out of the head and vary a resistance meter known as an E-meter, obviously we must be measuring this factor of the thetan plus his own energy masses. You see that? Now, you put an E-meter on a dead body, and you get a standard measurement. That's all there is to it. All dead bodies of one sex measure the same as all dead bodies of that sex. Now, if this thing is going to vary around, if this E-meter is going to vary around, something must vary it. But as Scientologists, we can do an additional experiment. We can clear somebody, at which time he gets just standard body resistance because his own resistances are no longer hinged onto the body, you see. They're no longer appended to the body. Or we can just kick somebody out of his head, you know. Oh, there's dozens of ways to do that. You walk up to somebody and say, try not to be 3 feet back of your head. And he normally will be 3 feet back of his head. They're on an inversion, you know. Upset him. Upset him terribly. Probably might even make him ill, but it's interesting. Now, if someone were to jump up before a broadcast chain microphone and say, just yell into the microphone, be 3 feet back of your head, you know, good and loud like this, he probably would have casualties all over the country. People would do a bunk. It'd be hours coming back, if ever, you know. They wouldn't know quite what happened, but they would have possibly obeyed this order. It's quite interesting. One Scientologist wrote a rather amusing story based on this. This fellow got on a chain broadcast network and did say, be 3 feet back of your head and cleared Earth. Now, Scientologists moving a thetan out of his head to a distance finds the E-meter dropped down to the resistance of the body. Just the body. Has the thetan come back into the head, then the resistance is different. Not necessarily higher or lower, it's just different. Get the idea? So you have a physical energy thing called an E-meter, which on this via can measure the density of whatever is stuck to the thetan more intimately than a body. And there is something stuck to a thetan more intimately than a body, a mind. And why is its mind stuck more intimately to a thetan than a body? And that's because he might or might not mock up bodies, but he for sure mocks up minds. And then forgets he's done them, and there they are. In other words, we're not dealing here with some ephemeral, esoteric, mystic substance called the mind at all. We're not dealing with such a substance at all. We're dealing with something which, to you as a Scientologist, will become as visible and as handleable as butterfly nets or steel cables or ashtrays or something. You know it's there, and you can do something about it, and so forth. Well, as I say, most of the people you'll be operating on haven't the courtesy of making their engrams visible. They're ashamed of them or something of this sort. And as a result, you sort of work in the dark. And the best tool to work with, known, is actually, aside from your own powers of observation and knowingness, is an E-meter. And this is an interesting tool. It tells you directly whether or not an engram is in restimulation or not. It tells you directly by the stone arm reading how much mass is accumulated in this person's mind. Now, when we say mass, of course, we mean just mass. Anything has mass. But you could imagine a gauzy, filmy sponge, couldn't you, that the light would shine directly through. You could imagine that. Now, imagine it just a little less light, you know, a little less opaque, you might say, so that light could go through it through much more easily. Now you can imagine it not being there and still understand that there is some mass there. Well, that's a ridge. That'd be the best way to describe a ridge. It's a piece of mass that doesn't stop or reflect light. That's mind. Now, the mind has basically, you might think, pictures and track and significances. No, a mind has in it matter, energy, space, and its own time factors. It has just exactly in it what the physical universe has in it, plus one thing, postulates. Now, the physical universe may or may not have postulates in it. We don't care about that. It's just matter, energy, space, and time. But a mind also has postulates in it. Now, I described to you originally four universes. You probably wondered and got these mixed up with the dynamics to some degree. Well, doesn't matter whether you did or didn't. These four universes are merely those things on which we have positive anatomy. That's all. See? The second dynamic doesn't have anatomy so much as purpose or an urge, you see. But the universe of the mind certainly does have an anatomy. and it's about the most precise anatomy you ever cared to look at. Now, whatever the significance of these masses, these spaces, these energies and time, they are just matter, energy, space, and time. Matter, you've got a wall. Energy, you have a light. Space, you have the distance between these walls. And time, you have the progressive, instant-to-instant progress of change. Well, they're visible in the physical universe. They exist just the same in the mind. They're just the same. You have matter, you have energy, you have space, and you have time, and postulates. Now, of course, these things accumulate into different forms and different significances. Now, we know what creates the mind today, and most people run when you tell them you create your own mind. That horrible picture with the terrible teeth in it that daily bites off your nose at 10:22 is of your own manufacture. And, of course, the first thing they say is no, because that's why it can bite their nose off, because they deny that they manufactured it. If they admitted that they manufactured it, it would go, whew. So one of the prime principles you must know about any universe is to keep it in a good, messy, chaotic, solid, disordered form, is to take no responsibility for ever having created it. Say God did it. You practically got it made. The more you say God did it, the more solid the universe is going to get, if you made it up. Get the idea? Listen, if God made it and that was the true ownership of it, it would disappear. Because that's assignment of proper ownership. That's taking a full responsibility for it. That's understanding exactly what its source was. And it would disappear, just like that. So you get these lies kicking around about who made what and why in somebody's mind, and you get persistence. So you have these still pictures, you have machines, you have circuits, you have other things that are persisting. Why are they persisting? Why are they troubling this person? Why every morning when he wakes up does he hear his poor old dead mother say, "Well now, Roger, get out of bed. You'll never make any money lying in bed. You're just like your father, always lying in bed, never making any money. You're just like your father." And he listens to this every morning. He's maybe by 50 about this time, you know, and his mother's been dead for years, and he gets up in the morning, and this thing says, "Roger, get out of bed. You're just like your father." Hey, over and over and over and over. Sometimes the people have spirit voices. Now, this is just an example of a spirit voice. It's a circuit. Well, circuits are no mystery in this day of electronics. But just how a thetan imbues some sort of a mass in his mind with the power of independent speech could be a mystery to you, unless you realize that all he had to do was mock it up and say it was something else, and he never had anything to do with it, and he didn't like it, and there it was, and he resisted it, don't you see? And after that, after he's mocked it up and then said he didn't mock it up, he's entered enough of a lie to get it to persist, you see? Well, of course, when it's a circuit of mother, it was simply a copy of her voice, a copy of her voice, a copy of her voice. But who was making the copy? Maybe mother was making the voice, but who was making the copy of the voice? Okay. Preclear was, of course. Well, he confuses the actual voice with making a copy of the voice, and when he hears this thing speak, he says this is mother. It's not mother, it's a copy of mother. Thus he makes a mistake, thus he can have some wonderful esoteric gadget known as a circuit. You'll run into a circuit someday. They're really wild. They're really, really very amusing, some of these circuits. Socrates had one, by the way. Call it his demon. He always asked it for advice. That just shows you how you can finally wind up getting a throat full of hemlock, too. Probably said, "Socrates, it's time to drink that stuff." Circuits are not necessarily your friends, believe me. You've mocked them up. You've disowned them. Do you think things are friendly that you disown totally? Did you ever disown another person totally and have him continue to be friendly with you? No, I don't think you ever did. Banks are not necessarily kind to their creators. This is what most people are upset about when they say, I have something wrong with my mind, or I have some disability of one character or another. Something's picking on them. Well, they disown the whole thing, and after that it can pick on them. It's very remarkable. If you want to start a fight without ever uttering a threatening word or anything, you can always do so by taking no responsibility of any kind for another person that you're in close association with. Just take no responsibility. Never help him through a door. Never open a door for him. Never offer him a cigarette. Never do anything, you see. Never take any responsibility for any of his comfort or anything. When he says something, don't reply. In other words, take no responsibility for him of any kind whatsoever. Never let him confide a trouble. Never listen to him in any way. You'll wind up with a fight on your hands, that's for sure, won't you? Well, similarly, people who do this with their minds wind up with a mind on their hands. And it can be sometimes a good heavy one that registers very, very high on an E-meter. Now, a circuit is that's a novelty. You won't often run into circuits. Lots of people have them and are them. Lots of times you run havingness on somebody. The circuit that he is being will move out from where he is, and he will be terribly upset. You've just gotten rid of his thinkingness, his voice, and his beingness. And you go, glub, glub, yeah. He'll say, well, I feel like a different person. Yeah, you've probably got another circuit that's ready to move out now. Well, that's curiosa. Circuits are not terribly important. They're just something that passes by in processing. You don't pay much attention to them. You should know what they are. This fellow gets visited every night by demons. Black thetans come in and see him every night. That's just a case of circuits, you see. Oh, they can mock up some wonderful circuits, too. Now, a man can mock up his whole mind outside of himself as a totally clear mind. He can mock up something that he calls the god Throgmagog that knows everything, that gives him all sorts of advice, and that is terribly brilliant and is totally capable of managing and running his whole life for him. Well, it's bright. You can, on a via, examine, on an examination paper, the god Throgmagog. But how do you have to get this fellow to get him to do this so that that Throgmagog is totally persistent? Well, you have to get the fellow in a state of total irresponsibility and tell him to do it while he's in a state of total irresponsibility. And that we call hypnotism. Hypnotism is a solved subject today in Scientology. All it is reducing an individual's responsibility down to a point where he is total effect. And if you can do this, then some very powerful manifestations will show up, and he'll be the total effect of all of them. They're actually not powerful at all. Let's take a one grasshopper power steam engine and a one beetle power caterpillar tractor. Now these two are of comparable force. Now let's take the caterpillar and move it down from one beetle power to one louse power. Now, of course, to this louse power caterpillar, this grasshopper powered thing, steam engine, will look awfully big and powerful, won't it? Well, that's what hypnotism does, and the apparent powerfulnesses of hypnotism simply consist of removing an individual downscale in weakness to a point where circuitry and that sort of thing looks terribly powerful. You get the idea? You can always make somebody 12 feet tall by shrinking yourself. That's, in essence, what happens. Well, these things become totally powerful simply because the individual takes no responsibility for them. In the first place, the hypnotist told him to mark it up. Well, he marked it up. Now, he takes no responsibility for it. Of course, apparently very powerful. Get the idea? There are numerous experiments of this character that can be undertaken. Circuits can be implanted. Various phenomena can be brought up and worked with in the field of the mind merely by handling this factor of responsibility. You just make a person totally irresponsible, you've got it made. You want to hypnotize anybody in the whole world. A hypnotist can only do 22% or something like that. It's about the same number as the automatic cure number. It doesn't matter what you do for 22% of the people. Give them flower pills or wave a magic wand or show them a magic healing crystal or invite them into a psychoanalytic consultation. They get well. 22% will get well no matter what you do for them. That's an interesting factor. It's only when the cure rate of a subject or profession drops below 22 that you can ask the embarrassing question, what are you doing to not get your 22%? Now, that's an automatic factor. 22% of the pre-clears you process. Practically doesn't matter what you run on. They sit down in the chair, they get well. As a consequence, we're interested in the other 78%. Much more interested, because we know then that it will be factual. You must, in doing research work, by the way, you must be very careful with this factor. You can take one or two cases, you see, and have something work like the living daylights, you know, just wham, just, oh boy, is this something, you see, and then never have it work again. You see, because you ran another 20 cases, but these 20 cases didn't fall within this 22% field, you see. So apparently you have something that's very, very workable. Most of these accidental, miraculous cures that you read about in papers and so forth merely fall within this 22%. And you can make these miraculous cures, too, just by snapping your fingers or waving your hand around in some interesting pattern, you know, or chanting some odd process, just almost at random. Person gets well. Don't fool yourselves. You have to know something to get the 78. Now you really have to know what you're doing. You start getting something like 50%, which was old Dianetics, and you're really going places. And I don't know where we're chomping in now, but it's up around maybe 91, 2, 3, with the average auditor that knows the modern processes. It's high. It's maybe not that high on HAS co-audit. I understand there were 4 people out of about 20 who were not making startling gains in a co-auditing muzzled class of a few weeks ago, you see. Actually, they merely hadn't been assessed properly and so on. But it was just a co-audit class, so you just chalk it up to accidental, you see. Well, that's roughly 80% were making excellent gains, you see. We've no business to make 80% actually wonderful gains unless we know our business. Well, that was on a co-audit where everybody was running muzzled and there weren't any auditors present except the instructor, you see, running a whole bunch of people. So if we're this good, why, we've certainly are traveling on know-how now, not on the accidental 22 that has fooled so many healing professions in the past. You know, some fellow is, you'll find practitioners stuck on this. It's one to beware. It's one to beware, definitely. He said, and all I said to the girl was, get the idea of being perfectly mated. And you know, she instantly got well, and she's been in wonderful condition ever since. And this fellow runs around trying to get other people to recover by telling them that they should be perfectly mated, you see. And the poor fellow, it wouldn't have mattered what he told the girl, you see. That was the fooler. He could have told her, get the idea that you've got to wash your feet every night and you get the same thing. He was just one of the miraculous 22. Well, these are cases to beware of because they're mostly hypnotic subjects, and when you look at them, you'll see their eyelids flutter slightly and so forth. They haven't any basic responsibility. They live totally on your responsibility and nobody else's. Now, hypnotism is simply that activity which inculcates a total irresponsibility or a near total irresponsibility on the part of the subject. And anything which does this brings about an hypnotic trance in anyone. If you could keep on and on and on explaining to somebody how he had no responsibility for that wall, after a while he'd just walk up to it and stick to it. If you really convinced him, you know, he'd finally stick to the wall. It would be there. He'd go to sleep at night and he'd still have the wall there. You see, he would have even made mock-ups of the wall and so on in a fabulous state of... He'd feel that he was still in the room. He'd produce all sorts of wild phenomena simply by reducing the responsibility factor. Now, as an auditor, you have a different vector. You're going in the opposite direction, and you are increasing the responsibility factor. Now, if you increase a person's responsibility for these various phenomena, they as is. His ability to handle them as is. So let's look over here at these two engines of the grasshopper power and the beetle power, and let's take the beetle-powered engine and make it one tiger power instead of reducing it down to one louse power. You got the idea? Entirely different proposition, but the trouble is so many beautifully interesting phenomena disappear when we do this. People no longer have demons visiting in the middle of the night. They no longer bleed in the proper thorn places on the proper days and so forth. It's quite interesting. I'm not being sarcastic. I'm just showing you these are the anatomy factors involved in all of this. Now, the mind is there, then, if it is there at all, to the degree that the individual is not taking responsibility for it. And that at once answers how much mental bric-a-brac an individual has. And it's all bric-a-brac. If you were interested in having bric-a-brac around, and you were quite able, you would simply mock it up and tell it to persist. It'd persist until you didn't want it, and then it wouldn't persist. If you wanted rattling chains to rattle and old tin cans and things that Thetans cart around with them to manifest, you would simply mock them up. And they'd be much better mock-ups than these automatic mock-ups, believe me. But Thetans get the idea that things have disappeared on them so often, they want to fix themselves up so nothing will disappear. And that's where we get these original postulates. Now, he's forgotten that he did it. And as the millennia goes on, why, the shark keeps biting his head off, and it was intended to bite off an enemy's head any time the enemy attacked the Thetan, you see? Now, it's reverse end, too, and he swapped valences, and he's on the target end of something he really intended to be on the sending end of. See, he mocked up a shark. And any time a Thetan attacked him, then the shark was supposed to bite the attacking Thetan, you see, or anything the attacking Thetan had. A very simple mechanism. But after a while, he's been attacked so often that he considers himself an attacked Thetan. He starts to attack something, and the shark bites him. You get the idea. He gets all confused about all this thing. And we get this mishmash that most people call a mind. Well, the mind doesn't think. It doesn't remember. It doesn't do anything. It simply exists. If anything is going to be done with this mind, then the owner of it has to do it himself. And then, of course, if he's on a low responsibility kick, he says, then my mind did that. He has to do it himself and then hide from himself the fact that he did it in order to have anything happen in the mind, so the mind is informing him. Now, this fellow has a mathematics circuit, and he's got this mathematics circuit all set up. Every time he thinks 2 plus 2, why, the mathematics circuit says 4. Nice, huh? Good. That's fine. How did it know how to say 4? That's a burning question. How did it know how to say 4? Well, he had to know that it would say 4 before it could say 4. I find this is true. In navigation, they say that a navigator is no good unless he knows intuitively whether or not his latitude and longitude position as computed is correct. You find this in Leckie, many of the navigational textbooks. A good navigator has an intuitive knowledge of the correctness of a computation. He's no good otherwise. You got an ensign or something, sub-lieutenant. But what is he doing using figures to find out where he is in the first place? But here we have demanded professionally that somebody's actual knowingness come up on the surface and simply be knowingness, not a circuit. So that anything the mind knows, the fellow has to know in the first place before the mind can know it. And the fellow then has to hide it from himself that he does know it so he can listen to his mind tell him. This is one of these wild contrivances, you know. You have a big telephone conversation with yourself whereby you're in a booth and the telephone wires run around in the room and come into the speaker, you see. And you hold this involved conversation with yourself, but you put a lag on it someplace or another, so you'll be fooled. Without noticing that you say, "Hello, Bill," the speaker says, "Hello, Bill," and you say, "Isn't that cute? Isn't that nice?" Well, that's basically what this universe of the mind's all about. Now, I won't go so far as to say the body and the physical universe obey the same laws because they're a bit more solid and they're a bit more detached, and that wouldn't be too real to people. But they can prove this in this universe of the mind rather easily. The solidities, its masses, its flows, its circuits, its other bric-a-brac, one kind or another, all follows this very observantly. And you ask an individual what part of a picture he can be responsible for, and it's staring at him, and he's staring at it, and it's about to eat him up or something of the sort, and he finally looks around and decides he could be responsible for the place where it is, but nothing much else. And then he's responsible for this about it and that about it. And the next thing you know, the thing dims out and gets stronger and dims out and starts changing and moves in time and pretty soon resolves. If your PC is in any kind of a good condition at all, he can do just almost nothing but a responsibility process from beginning to end of a clearing. He has to be in pretty good condition before he can start in on such a line. It's a rather high-level approach. Your big contest is to get somebody up to a point where he can be responsible enough to run responsibility. Otherwise, it's just a word or symbol to them. They're not really taking responsibility. They're just doing what you said because you said to. All right. Now, that's what holds the anatomy of the mind in place. Person puts it there and gets it to persist and forgets that he did it and takes no responsibility for having done it, and he gets a persistence, one character or another. Now, the various items, the actual items in the mind in which you're interested, I mentioned one, an esoteric item, circuits, talking gramophone records, and they do all sorts of things these circuits do. Another esoteric item is machinery. And every now and then somebody is very dazzled to discover that we meant machinery when we said machinery. You know, they say, well, machinery, that's a colloquial term of some sort or another. No, we mean machinery. It has wheels and belts and chimneys and rods that go this way while rods go that way, you know. It's machinery. It really is. Cog wheels and all that sort of thing. You'll be processing a pre-clear sometime or another. You keep glancing over there as you're processing, you know. You glance over there some more. You finally say, what's the matter? You see something? Yeah, I don't know. There's something that looks like a steam locomotive that makes candy over there. This thing has been developing into his view. It's been there for a very, very long time. He's just stopped not-izzing it, you see. And he starts looking at the thing, and it's some gaudy big machine with its belly painted red and a brass polished stack on it and gear wheels and meters and dials and so forth. We mean machinery, in other words, really. Now, part of the machinery is devoted to different functions in the mind. And a mind which is off on the machinery is off onto such a total irresponsibility, there's hardly any hope for the fellow at all. This is the stage 4 needle. He's totally dedicated to machinery and circuits. The individual himself is a circuit, and everything he does is run by machinery. He's the most... He looks more like a factory than a human being. Stage 4 needle is a characteristic low-level needle on an E-meter. And it means practically no responsibility. The person can't even influence an E-meter until you get him upscale a little bit. The E-meter always does the same thing. It moves up and sticks and falls back. Just keeps doing it. This individual's got machinery. Well, he has machinery that makes mock-ups, and then other machinery which eats up mock-ups. He has consuming machinery and manufacturing machinery. He has factories that make lies and factories which believe lies. And he has factories which destroy lies. And he's real well lied out along the whole line. Anyway, as the individual comes up scale, he is less and less mechanical, you might say. It isn't all being done for him. He hasn't got himself all gimmicked up one way or the other. And he comes out into the more ordinary phenomena that you will meet in auditing. Now, I've talked about circuits, I've talked about machinery. We probably won't talk about them again because these things show up and disappear. But when one shows up on a PC, don't be upset. I have given you a clue that they exist, and don't sit there with your jaw dropped. You know, and don't do anything about it, because what you're doing turned it on. What you're running will turn it off. That's for sure. But you can explain some of his behavior and some of his complaints and so forth by circuits and machinery. Every time he puts up a mock-up, an arm comes out here, picks it up, turns it over, writes a date on it, puts it back this way, and files it over here in a file. You'd be surprised. You ask somebody for an answer to your question, and he says, just a minute. You should inquire sometime why he has to have just a minute. It's because the answer is always carried around past his face on a little string of toy cars. And these are little flat cars, and each one has a word on a flat car. It's a word per flat car. And he's got to wait till this whole little train of flat cars comes around so they can read the words off and give you the answer to the question. These are dub-in cases that have these sort of things. It's nothing new. It isn't modern. This type of machinery and circuits and tapes and things like that. I ran into a tape in Greek one time, clear back in Greek days, running a Greek engram, and evidently the person went alive, ran totally on a little ticker tape, piece of papyrus that came out here, you know, and it said in Greek symbols whatever it said in Greek symbols. The thing was still operating 2,000 years later. You run into these are really fascinating. They're not very meaningful, but it means that you've got a tremendous amount of dub-in on the case. You have artificial valences. You have to dig around for quite a while to find the preclear, you see. The more machinery that's present, the more circuits that are present, the less preclear you've got. You got that? Because he has to be pretty irresponsible to let all the machinery do his living for him. All right, now let's get into what you'll really be handling. And I can name that off just brrr. You'll be handling things that are called technically locks. And those are just pictures that hang around. Individual remembers something, he sees a picture. A picture isn't painful or anything. He thinks of cats, he sees a picture of a cat. And so on. It's a picture of a certain cat in a certain place. Now, locks are actually copies of the physical universe, and that is a lock. If it isn't a copy of the physical universe, and yet it is automatic, it is a dubbed-in picture or a dubbed-in lock. It's a dub-in, in other words. It represents something that there is a picture of the real thing present, but he looks at a substitute of the real picture. Get the idea? That's a lock. And then a person has the capability of simply mocking up something, just creating it out of whole cloth. That is not a lock. That is his own created object that is not a copy of anything necessarily. We call that a mock-up. All right. Now, a secondary is a mis-emotional experience contained in a mental image picture, or a mental image picture of a mis-emotional experience. And a secondary is called a secondary because it has to have, prior to it, an incident of physical pain in order to exist. Don't ever try to get a lock, a secondary, off on an ally or person in the preclear's life who never gave any duress of any kind to the person. He won't have a secondary. He won't have a mis-emotional experience. You understand? This miss emotional experience depends on a physical pain thing prior to it. Now, he could misidentify people and cry about somebody or get mad about somebody that had never hurt him. But that secondary doesn't belong to the person he's talking about. It belongs on some other chain and some other person that he has identified. All right, a secondary then is simply misemotional. That could be anger, antagonism, or grief, or fear. Some of the tougher ones don't get into the idea that release of affect, as the psychoanalyst said, always and only has to do with grief. Some of the rougher charges you will handle in cases are terror charges, right there at 1.0, and oh man, you see one of those rip off the case. Well, it's a mental image picture containing terror. The individual is so influenced by the picture that he responds totally to the picture, and he goes through terror. This screaming, shuddering terror. Well, he feels unhappy about somebody, liable to cry and cry about it. And if he feels very apathetic, he'll go through a long period of apathy while he's running this secondary. These secondaries are quite interesting. It is better to get off the primary, which is the engram itself. But a secondary can be run all by itself, and if discharged, can completely change the experience or behavior pattern of the person. Like the girl has just lost a husband. She's run 9 hours on a secondary. The secondary is totally erased. She looks like a young girl again. She can confront her life and she can go on living. It's a rather marvelous thing, the results that can be obtained from running a secondary if the preclear can attack and run one. The engram is the most that you see. Now, you have an idea that an engram is a picture, like you see a three-dimensional small movie or something like that. You've got the wrong idea. An engram fully developed becomes, if anything, more real to the preclear than present time. And it is a three-dimensional picture that has mass, motion, space, time. It contains, as its definition indicates, physical pain, unconsciousness, and exteriorization. Therefore, an incident in Scientology which does not contain these three things does not classify as an engram. An engram is a mental image picture containing physical pain, unconsciousness, and exteriorization. Now, these, just this little handful of things, are the principal anatomy that you will have to do with. And these things are draped along another piece of anatomy called the time track. Now, some people get the idea that the time track is a drawn-up picture out in front of them. No, it isn't. It actually is the way they file or stack up all of their experiences in chronological order. It is not a picture. It is actually the chronological order of all pictures. And it makes up something that is called the time track. Now, locks, secondaries, engrams appear on the time track, and one of the ways of deadening or desensitizing any one of these items is simply to find its proper place on the time track, at which moment it's very likely to disappear, deintensify. You can put a person's time track back together again, but it's become scrambled, and you can do a tremendous amount for him. You just sit there with an E-meter, take experiences that he can see, you know, in terms of locks, secondaries, engrams, and just find each one in time for him. And gradually get his time track lined up and he would be in much better shape, that all by itself. So the time track is not so much a thing, but an order of things. And the things in which we are interested, of course, are engrams, secondaries, locks, mock-ups, dubbed-in pictures, which are pictures of pictures because he can't face the real picture, he faces a substitute. And more esoterically and less practically, machinery and circuits. And when we've said this whole mouthful, why, we've said about all mental anatomy there is. Thank you.